Good morning, everyone. It is good to see everyone out. We have a good number of visitors this morning. We wanted to let you know that you're welcome here. We thank you for coming. Hope that you'll be back with us. You make up a nice filling for some of the empty spots we have. We have a number of people out, and we're anxious to see them again, but we're glad to have everyone here this morning. If you have a Bible, you might be turning over into the Gospels. We're going to get there in just a minute, towards the tail end. We're going to be looking at, the title I gave the lesson this morning was The Trial of the Millennia. And my wife, who is the grammarian in the family, when she was putting that in the bulletin, looked at me and said, do you mean millennium or millennia? You know, most people would go, what's the difference? I'd looked it up. No, it's not just the last millennium, which is 1,000 years, but millennia, multi-thousands of years, right? The trial of Jesus, this time period that was right around his trial and crucifixion and resurrection, was a pivotal point in history. And anybody who wants to deny that simply hasn't looked at the calendar and the way we keep time, right? What do we call that point? We are in the year what? 2015 AD. Now, see, people have gotten where they don't want that anymore. And you'll see this lettering called BC and BCE. Now, we say BC is before Christ. Now, what they now say is that was before the Common Era and the Common Era. I'm sorry, it didn't change anything, right? That's still centered around this point in time when they thought that Jesus was the one who came and was born. And it's his life that was pivotal in his history. And it's his death and his resurrection that are pivotal when it comes to our salvation and our renewed relationship with God. We talked last week about the master's last class, the time when Jesus had with his disciples and the last few lessons that he wanted to teach them because he knew his time was short and things were going to be happening very quickly. This morning we're going to be looking at that time period that's the betrayal and his arrest and the trial primarily. And then next week I'm going to concentrate on the crucifixion. We're coming up to the point of Easter, which is going to be next Sunday. And what's interesting about that is we know, because of the way that the Bible is written here, when these events occurred in terms of the time of year. Have you ever wondered why the date for Easter floats around? You know, there are certain holidays that, you know, because it's on the X day of the month or it's on the X week of the month, whatever, right? We vote on the first Tuesday after the first Monday, you know, those kinds of things. Well, they kept a lunar calendar. They went by the months as the moon. And so on the 14th of Nisan, which is that towards the evening, is when the sacrifices were being offered. And then it went into evening, which in the Jewish calendar would have been the Friday night before Friday morning. It would have been the full moon because that's the middle of that month. And so Passover is always on the full moon. Now, why do I say that? Because they'd eaten the Passover meal. And you got to remember, Jerusalem is crowded. There's a lot of people there. And it'd been kind of a tumultuous, long day as they're getting ready for the Passover. And you can imagine people grabbing all the last-minute things and getting in, going through that meal, having to cook a lamb. That's a long process. That doesn't take just a few minutes, right? They didn't have microwave ovens to do all of this. And then there's the eating and Jesus teaching the disciples. It's getting late. It's dark. It's probably, you know, somewhere between 10 o'clock and midnight. And they're finally finished with this, and Jesus has them all get up and to go over to the place that John tells us was his custom to go. Now, we have four Gospels that give us this account. And there are different details in each Gospel. We're going to be doing some reading from some this morning, but I want to try to put a lot of those details together for you. And as we look at this today, this is kind of like an act in two parts, or a play in two parts, or two acts, where we have this coming time when they're going to arrest Jesus, and then we have that trial that he goes through. And I want you to think about all of the people that were involved in this, and how they would have been reacting to the situation, and the things that would have been going on. We've got a bunch of people here. There's Judas. He plays a very important part. We have Jesus, of course, and his disciples with him. But I'm looking at the people that are surrounding Jesus. There's going to be soldiers and high priests and priests. We got a few slaves involved. There's a guy that's going to get his ear cut off at some point, right? And he's the slave of the high priest. There's another interesting fellow we'll run into from Mark that's in this time as well. And then we're going to have Pilate and Herod. And what I want you to think about as we're going through is how these people were reacting to the situation, thinking about the things that motivated them, the things that caused them to react as they did as they went through this time period. Now, we don't know Judas's motivations, but Judas had left during the Passover meal. He's gone, but he knew where Jesus was going to be. And so he goes and finds the soldiers that had already been allocated for him, and he goes, okay, guys, it's time. They've been looking for a way to get Jesus, but they haven't been able to isolate him. We see the Garden of Gethsemane, it's an olive garden. There's an olive press there that's not being used at this time of year, obviously. And it's a little quieter place where Jesus has gone to pray. He's asked his disciples to pray with him, but they're kind of tired. They don't know what's coming, and they're having a hard time staying awake. It's getting late. It's getting past their bedtime. And finally, Jesus says, it's time. Now, Judas had given some instructions to the guards and things with him. And you can imagine these folks. These are probably the temple guards. They're the ones who were Jewish and responsible for the safety and security around the temple. They were allowed weapons and things and were under the oversight kind of the Roman authorities, but they were Jewish guards. And they've collected their weapons and swords and spears. And they're coming out, and they're following Judas. And Jesus told them, look, okay, we're going to be, you know, marching into this garden. And the guy you want is the one I'm going to go up and kiss. Okay? Now, this is like you've seen the greetings where they, you know, they kiss them on both cheeks kinds of thing. It's how you would greet someone who was a close friend, a relative, a good associate. And he says, that's how you'll know who's the one that you're going to have to arrest. So as they go into the garden, Judas is leading these officers in, and they're approaching Jesus, and Jesus sees him coming. And he says, who are you looking for? Who do you want? Well, they kind of, you know, this is unexpected. Jesus is the one who takes the initiative if you look at John, the book of John. And so they kind of stop a little bit, and one of them will say, we're looking for Jesus of Nazarene. Now, Jesus says, I am he. Now, if you read John's account, those people fall down. You see, what they've done is he has used the same language that he used earlier when he was telling them, as before Abraham was born, I am. So when he said, I am he was admitting to them again that he was God. They weren't sure how to take that. So there's this standoff here. Judas, he's got his plan in place, and so he just walks up to Jesus. He's been with Jesus for 3 years. He has no fear. And he says, Hail, Rabbi! And he kisses him. And Jesus looks at him and says, You're going to betray me with a kiss? What kind of irony is that? But now they know who it is. Now remember, it's night. And it might be a full moon, but if you've ever been out in the woods or in a place where there's a lot of trees on a full moon, it's not like you can really see all that well. But they've got the torches there. And his disciples now know that something is up. Because these people, this isn't normal. This isn't what should be there. And just before they had left, Jesus had talked to them about this journey that they were going to go on and had asked them if they had any swords. And so we know at least two of them had swords. We know Peter had one of them. I don't know who had the other one. But I think it was the other guy, probably, that looks at Jesus and goes, Is it time for the swords now? Is it time for the swords? Peter's the one who doesn't bother asking, right? Peter's the one who simply pulls the sword out and goes at it. Now, you got to remember, Peter's not a professional soldier. What's his occupation? He's a fisherman. Okay? Now, I think hauling those nets all day and working as a fisherman, manual labor like that, my impression of Peter is that he's a buff kind of guy, okay? He's strong. Now, he may not know exactly how to wield a sword professionally. But you take a big, strong guy, give him a sword, and he starts swinging it, something's going to happen. And he starts swinging at the first person that's right there in front of his master, which happens to be the slave of the high priest. Now this guy ducks, but not far enough, and gets his right ear cut off. The first blood has been let. Now what's Jesus' reaction? He immediately cries out. He says, stop that. Of course, you can see Peter. He's ready to swing again. And Jesus says, stop. Well, he knows his master's voice. And he stops. What? He says, no, Peter, put the sword away. Those who take up the sword will die by the sword. That's not what this time is all about. How else do you think this is going to get fulfilled if you guys start fighting? Well, you know, this had to cause some confusion with the rest of the disciples as well, because if they're not going to fight, if they're not going to protect this guy that's been their master for these years, what are they there for? They're stunned. They don't understand. And so Jesus then looks at the soldiers and he says, I've told you that I'm Jesus. So just take me and let all these others go. He's protecting his disciples. And he's saying, I'm the one you want. These aren't the ones you want. And then he walks over and he picks up this bloody piece of severed ear and attaches it back to Malchus. Now, I want to know what he's thinking right now. Can you imagine? He's come out to arrest somebody. Now, he may not know the whole story, although Jesus is a pretty popular guy. Remember, he's been approached a lot of times in the temple and in the tabernacle, and people have been after him this whole week. He's been present. And here a miracle has been performed. But that doesn't stay them. They've got their orders. What are they going to do? Peter says, well, should we fight? And Jesus says, you know, if it were time to fight, I have 12 legions of angels I could call. Now, how do you think the soldiers would have fared against 12 legions of angels? How many does it say took out all the firstborn in Egypt? One. This isn't a fair fight if Jesus decides it's a fight. But he decides it's not a fight. This is the way it's supposed to happen. And so his disciples, they're not sure what's going to go on. But the commander then binds the hands of Jesus. His disciples all flee. And if you look at Mark in the 14th chapter, there's a really interesting little incident there. Somebody else had kind of heard the ruckus, had known that something was going on, and had jumped out of bed and basically just wrapped up in a sheet in whatever his sleeping clothes were, which probably weren't, you know, for public appearance, and poked down to see what was going on. And he got too close to the goings-on, and when the soldiers are there, and they're trying to say, you know, okay, who else are we going to grab, and everybody's starting to run, here's this guy in a sheet, well, he's got to be part of them, so somebody grabs him, he just abandons that and runs off, and the Bible says he ran off naked. He says, I don't want any part of this either. Probably, it doesn't say who it was, but since it's in the book of Mark, and we know that Mark is the one that wrote the gospel, and we know that Mark was very close to the disciples and was a follower of Peter, probably was Mark. Probably was Mark. But the stage has been set. And if that were the curtain, it would come down on this bunch of soldiers dragging Jesus off. Now they've got a plan. They've been looking forward to this time when they could isolate him from his followers, from those who would support him. You remember when he was teaching, they didn't want to try to get him then because there were too many people in the crowds that would have stood up for this. They'd seen the miracles that Jesus had done. He had healed some of them. But they've got him isolated now. And they're going to take him before Annas. So this trial now has three parts. It starts before Annas, and then it's going to have another more formal trial before Caiaphas and the Sanhedrin, and then they're going to have to go before Pilate. Because you see, their intent is that Jesus be killed. And the Jews, even with their soldiers and all, did not have the authority under the Romans to do that themselves. So they're going to need Roman help on this, and they know it. But they first got to figure out a way to get these charges to stick. So turn over with me to John, the 18th chapter. We're going to read verses 12 through 24. Actually, we're going to read 12 through 14, and then I'm going to skip down to 19 and read through 24. So the Roman, before I say this, if your translation says the Roman cohort there, notice that Romans in italics, it probably is not the Romans, okay? This is the Jewish cohort, the Jewish soldiers that are with him. So the cohort and the commander and the officers of the Jews arrested Jesus and bound him and led him to Annas first, for he was father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was high priest that year. Now Caiaphas was the one who had advised the Jews that it was expedient for one man to die on behalf of the people. So they're taking him to Annas. Annas had been the high priest, but the high priesthood now is almost a political thing. And the Romans had kind of ousted Annas, and they put Caiaphas in there, his son-in-law. But the Jews still respected Annas and their position that he had. And so he's the first one that gets to examine him. Now you've got to imagine that some others are going ahead to Caiaphas and telling him to get ready, because they're going to wind up showing up at Caiaphas' residence, at his front door. That's where a lot of this is going to happen. So they come before Annas, and the high priest then questioned Jesus about his disciples and about his teaching. And Jesus answered him and said, I have spoken openly to the world. I always taught in the synagogues and in the temple where all the Jews come together, and I spoke nothing in secret. Why do you question me? Question those who have heard what I spoke to them. They know what I said. And when he had said this, one of the officers standing nearby struck Jesus, saying, is that the way you answer the high priest? And Jesus answered him, if I have spoken wrongly, then testify of the wrong. But if rightly, why do you strike me? And so Annas sent him bound to Caiaphas, the high priest. Now you might remember as we go through this, that in Isaiah 53, some of this had been prophesied. And it is said that as a sheep is dumb, stands before its shearers, so he opened not his mouth. One of the things that you'll see is that Jesus isn't completely quiet. He's talking. He is answering some of these people. But I want you to notice as he goes through and talks to them, he never defends himself. He's always trying to get these people to see what they're doing and to understand the situation. And they don't. But he's not defending himself here. And that's what Isaiah 53 is talking about. Is the dumb before his shearers, is he's offering no defense for what they're charging him. So Annas gets some time with Jesus, asks him a bunch of questions. Did you notice how Jesus answered? He goes, why are you asking me? Why aren't you asking all of the people that have heard me? Nothing's been done in secret. You see, what we have to understand from a Jewish trial perspective is that things were already going wrong. Whenever there was a capital trial, we can understand from the previous Jewish writings and from books like the Mishnah, that they had a procedure that they were supposed to go through. They were supposed to take the witnesses, and on the day before the trial, the witnesses would come before the whole council, and the witnesses would be addressed, and they would be told, look, this is a very serious proceeding. We're talking about somebody's life here. So we want you to speak only the truth. And we want you to not say anything that's just hearsay or any suppositions that you may have. We only want to hear the facts. And then the witnesses would be let go. The next day would be the trial. And those witnesses would be coming forward. And the witnesses were the ones who were supposed to corroborate whatever charges were being brought. And then if there was a guilty verdict, they were supposed to stop the proceedings that evening. And all of the Sanhedrin would go away, and overnight, by at least pairs, they would discuss the trial with each other. And when they came back the next morning, they would be offered an opportunity to change their vote, but only if they had voted to be guilty. You see, they wanted to make sure in their trial process that things were done right. And the person who was being convicted was truly responsible for whatever crime that he's on trial for. Clearly, that's not being followed. That's why Jesus brings up, Where are the witnesses? When he says, ask somebody else. There's nobody else there that they're calling up as witnesses. Annas just says, okay, time to go to Caiaphas. The trial by the Sanhedrin is next. Probably sometime before dawn. It's been a long night. Turn over to the book of Matthew. And let's look at Matthew 26. Matthew 26, beginning in verse 57. And we're going to read down through verse 68. Then those who had seized Jesus led him away to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the scribes and the elders were gathered together. But Peter was following him at a distance as far as the courtyard of the high priest and entered in and sat down with the officers to see the outcome. Now the chief priests and the whole council kept trying to obtain false testimony against Jesus so that they might put him to death. They did not find any, even though many false witnesses came forward. But later on, two came forward and said, this man stated, I am able to destroy the temple of God and to rebuild it in 3 days. And the high priest stood up and said to him, do you not answer? What is it that these men are testifying against you? Stop there for a second. I want you to understand what's going on. They're looking for witnesses. They're looking for something that they can make stick. And anything that they have, they're going to need two at least. Okay? That's just the way the law was. You needed at least two witnesses. Now, what are people going to come and testify about Jesus? That he healed my daughter? He raised Lazarus from the dead? Those are not the kind of things they want to bring up in this trial. And so have you ever thought about this charge that he finally comes to? We heard him say that he could destroy the temple and rebuild it in 3 days. Now, we might think that's pretty trivial, but this is exactly what they needed. You see, the temple was the icon of Judaism. The temple was where the presence of God was supposed to dwell. It wasn't real personal from a standpoint of like, oh, healing somebody who's sick, or the man with the withered hand, or Lazarus from the dead. No, the temple was something that was Jewish identity. And he said, I can destroy that. Now they've got something that maybe people could rally around a little bit. And not only that, he said, I can rebuild it in 3 days. You know how long Herod had been working on that temple? At least 20 years. We've been under construction. Now, can you imagine him saying, I can rebuild it in 3 days? Now, of course, that's not what he was talking about. But if he's going to rebuild it in 3 days, there's only one way that happens. And that is if he's using the power of God or some power. And so now maybe this is something they can make stick. And so they stand up and they say, answer us. Notice how he phrases it. Jesus keeps silent, and the high priest said to him, I adjure you by the living God that you tell us whether you are the Christ, the Son of God. There's the real charge. And Jesus said to him, you have said it yourself. Nevertheless, I tell you hereafter, you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power and coming on the clouds of heaven. And then the high priest tore his robes and said, he has blasphemed. What further need do we have of witnesses? Behold, you have now heard the blasphemy. What do you think? They answered. He deserves death. And then they spat in his face and beat him with their fists, and others slapped him. And they said, prophesy to us, you Christ. Who is the one who hit you? So now, the real thing that was under their skin is out. That Jesus had claimed to be God. And that he had claimed to be the Son of God. That he had claimed to be Emmanuel, God with us. We can't lose sight of that. As we continue and look at what's going to come next, they've got their charge. They've got something they can rile the Jewish people up with and change their opinion. We've got to change it so Jesus is no longer the rock star. The crowds have to be against him. But we've got to do it to the Romans now. And so they're going to bundle Jesus up and head him off and take him to the Romans. It's just about daylight. They probably knew better than to get Pilate out of bed. But things start when the sun rises, when you don't have atomic clocks and wristwatches and alarm clocks. So Pilate is probably getting up in the morning, and he's staring at himself at this bronze mirror and wondering what in the world he did to deserve the assignment that he's got there in Palestine. Palestine was not a cushy place. He'd already been in trouble once with the Roman authorities for using excessive force to put down some Jewish rebellions. He was the fifth prefect of the Roman province of Judea from AD 26 to 36. He was serving under the emperor Tiberius. His job is to maintain peace and to make sure that the taxes flow to Rome. That's his job. And on his bedroom door that morning, there's a knock, and one of his centurions probably says, Pilate, we got a little problem. There's this really big crowd of Jews that are gathered out in the praetorium, and they're screaming and shouting about something, and they want you there. And I can just imagine Pilate going, not again. What's it this time? So he's going to go out, and he's going to have to talk to the people. It's near sunrise, and if you look over in John, the 18th chapter, beginning in verse 28, John 18, beginning verse 28, says that they led Jesus from Caiaphas and into the praetorium, and it was early. And they themselves did not enter into the praetorium so that they would not be defiled, but might eat the Passover. And therefore Pilate went out to them and said, what accusation do you bring against this man? And they answered and said to him, if this man were not an evildoer, we would not have delivered him to you. And so Pilate said, well, take him yourselves and judge him according to your law. But the Jews said to him, we are not permitted to put anyone to death to fulfill the word of Jesus which he spoke, signifying by what kind of death he was about to die. Therefore Pilate entered again into the praetorium and summoned Jesus and said to him, are you the king of the Jews? And Jesus answered, are you saying this on your own initiative? What did others tell you about me? Pilate answered, I'm not a Jew, am I? Your own nation and the chief priests delivered you to me. What have you done? And Jesus answered, my kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would be fighting so that I would not be handed over to the Jews. But as it is, my kingdom is not of this realm. I want you to understand what Jesus is saying here. Pilate's been disturbed in his day. This is not what he wants to do. He's got a crowd of angry people that could turn into a riot. And the Jews say, this guy is guilty. And Pilate says, of what? Well, if he wasn't guilty, we wouldn't have given him to you. How do you like that logic? There's a good reason for you. And Pilate says, okay, well then just go judge him and do what? You know, the Jews could have legally flogged Jesus to within an inch of his life. They had the authority to do that. Well, that's not what they wanted. And so they told Pilate, sorry, you got to take this one. Because this guy's deserving death. Now, in Pilate's view, there's only a couple of things that can deserve death. Most of them revolve around insurrection. Somebody who's trying to create trouble. So he's going to look down at Jesus and he's going to see a man who's been beaten. He's wearing dirty clothes because he's been, you know, gone through this trial at night. He's tired. And he doesn't look like a threat. And there's no disciples around him. There's nobody with a sword trying to break him free. And he's not struggling. And he says, bring him in. And he asks one question. He says, are you the king of the Jews? What does he mean by that? He means, you're going to try to lead these people in a revolt? You're going to try to take over this place? If so, we got a problem. And Jesus says, if that were the case, my disciples would be out there fighting. Now, I'm no threat to you. Now what's Pilate going to do? Well, just so happens it's Passover. And Herod's in town. And Herod, who's in charge of Galilee area, is another Roman authority, but he's got closer ties to the Jews. We do what every good politician wants to do with a really difficult problem. You give it to somebody else, right? Not my job. So they take Pilate and they're going over to Herod. Now Herod's real excited about this. Herod says, you know what? This is cool. I've been hearing about this guy. And I heard he can do magic tricks. Maybe he'll do one for me. But when he's brought before Herod, Herod looks at him and goes, this is it? Pilate, you take him. I don't want anything to do with this. He's in your jurisdiction. But you know what? Because Pilate had shown Herod some courtesy that day, the two that didn't like each other, they started to be good friends. I got to wonder about anybody who'd be a good friend with Herod. Okay, most of Herod's friends wound up dead, folks. Most of his relatives wound up dead. So it tells you a little something about Pilate. So Pilate brings him back. He has Jesus scourged, hoping that that'll satisfy the crowd. It doesn't. He offers to release a really bad criminal, thinking we got to give, you know how you deal with two-year-olds? You give them choices, right? He's dealing with these crowds like a two-year-old. He's going to try to give them choices. And he says, I'm going to put this really bad guy here and this guy Jesus, who really doesn't look like much. Which one do you want me to release? We'll take the bad guy. And at this point, the crowds are starting to chant, crucify him. And they're getting rough. Pilate's trying to figure out what he's going to do, and he gets a note from his wife that says, don't do anything. I had a dream about this guy. This is not going to turn out well. But he doesn't have much choice. What's he going to do? And so he says, all right, I'm washing my hands. You guys brought him, you guys want him dead, fine. One person dying, that's better than a riot. And at least I won't get in trouble with the Romans again for trying to put down a riot. Tells the soldiers, take him, crucify him. That was the trial. Can you imagine? That was the trial. Every step along the way, there were people who should have known better about what was going on. And they paid no attention. It was just railroaded through. But have you thought about where you might have stood? I think that we can see characteristics of each of these people in ourselves. How about these chief priests? You think they thought they were doing what was right? You see, when they charged him with blasphemy, as they told Pilate, in their law, blasphemy deserved death. If they didn't believe that this man was the Son of God, then they were acting, I would say in good conscience, but there were a lot of other things around it, but they were acting on what they felt was right. Jesus is led away. He goes through the streets. He's brought out and crucified. When his body is ready to come down off the cross, Joseph of Arimathea is the one who gets his body to put it in his own tomb. There's an interesting thing that's said about Joseph. If you look at take a look at the Gospels, it says that he, although a leader of the Jews, had not agreed with what was going on. Do you realize that there were people who didn't want this to happen? How about those women who were standing at the cross or who were following him as he was being led to the cross and weeping? They had no power. They couldn't stop it. But they followed, and they stayed close. And even John shows up, because he's at the foot of the cross as well. How about the centurion who arrests Jesus, the slave that gets his ear cut off? Each of them interacted in some way with this man who was going to be condemned, who was going to be put to death. Where do we stand? What do we do? I hope that as we think about this and see that this death, this needless death from the world's perspective, but needed from God's perspective. God made it happen. That's tough to think about, isn't it? That Jesus had to die? But he did it for one reason. And that's for us. When we look at that trial, when we look at what he endured, when we look at how our lives have been impacted, and not just us, but the lives of the world, then we need to understand that there was love that drove that through the entire process. Where would you be if you were standing at the cross? Next week, we're going to talk about the resurrection. Because you see, if the story had ended there, If the Romans had nailed him up between those two thieves, and then he's in the grave and he's dead, that would have been the end of the story. We wouldn't even be here. Because we would be, of all people, most miserable if we were worshiping somebody who just died. But he didn't. He rose. And we're going to talk about that next week. We're going to talk about that next week. So come. Let's talk about the great resurrection. But this morning, if you haven't given your life to Christ, you need to think about where you would have stood. Whose side would you have been on? You know, Peter denied him three times. He fled. And we can look back on that and say, fair, but for the grace of God go I. But there was an important thing about Peter. He came back and turned into one of the strongest disciples that Jesus had. So even mistakes can be washed away. And the record can be clean. And we can be good servants of God. So I encourage you, if you need something done in your life, if we can help you in any way, why don't you do that? Why don't you come while together we stand and we sing?